got the password?
Walt sent me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 138 of Walt Sent Me, the podcast where we look at the cinematic legacy of the Walt Disney Company and its various subsidiaries. My name is Todd Liebenow, and with me is Kristen Lopez.
Hello, hello.
And this time we are venturing into the Miramax years for Disney, looking at the 2002 feature film Frida. We also have a short, of course, and some news items. So let's just jump right in with the news. Let's go right to the world of Marvel. Since we last recorded, WandaVision has wrapped up. We are just a few days away now from the debut of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. But let's just give some closing thoughts here on WandaVision. Kristen, of course, last time we talked, you were very hyped about the show. We're enjoying it. I was as well. What do you think about how it all wrapped up?
I think it wrapped up about as well as it was ever going to. You know, there's been a lot of controversy over fan theories and what fan theories were listened to, which was pretty much none of them.
Yeah, the fans being upset that, you know, they were wrong. Oh, boo-hoo, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, I like that. I think I mentioned when we talked about the series before that I liked that it was not heavy on the MCU stuff. I like that you could watch it as somebody who was not a fan of any of the movies that came before it. And I think that it was nice that the series ended that way. And Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany did some work. I fully expect whatever comes after to not be nearly as good as this. So it'll be good to see Elizabeth Olsen continue in the role. I had a lot of fun with it.
I did too. I of course took in all the fan theories and such, and you know, would have been excited to see various things, but I was like, you know, nobody knows. So I'm just going to let it play out the way it plays out. And I thought the ending was quite satisfying. They lay the groundwork for some things, you know, where you're thinking about, okay, is this going to tie into the next Doctor Strange, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think it was kind of cool to see the Scarlet Witch character kind of in a form more like the comic book version that we see. And you know, I think that opens up some neat new possibilities. So, yeah, I enjoyed the series a lot. And I really have no complaints. Like I've said before, every week my kids and I made sure to carve out a certain amount of time to watch it. And it was rough on us the last weekend because my kids had some other things they had to do and we did not get to watch it until I think it was Sunday afternoon. You know, I mean, that's tough to hold off on what everybody else on the internet is saying, but I managed to do it. And yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. So now we have The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. As we're recording this, we are just about 5 days away from the debut. But Kristen got some inside stuff here a few days ago, so we're going to let her share about this. By the time this episode hits, probably a bunch of you will have seen the first episode. But yeah, Kristen, tell us about The Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yeah, so I got to see the pilot, which, again, as somebody who is not real big on the MCU lore, I thought this was a really interesting take on the material as it takes place in a post blip world. So this is essentially what these characters are going through now that everybody has returned and Endgame has, pun intended, ended. Where do these characters go from here? Where does Sam Wilson as the Falcon go after being handed the shield by Cap America? If you didn't see Endgame,
yeah, where are you?
You're listening to this podcast. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. So I think that it's a really unique take, especially because Anthony Mackie being one of the few men of color that is in this series, and as well, I mean, our first possibly black Cap America. What does that mean? So there's a lot of really interesting discussion. We see his backstory, and I was really into his plot line. As far as the Winter Soldier goes, you're also dealing with Bucky having to navigate the horrible things that he did when he was the Winter Soldier and trying to similar to Captain America, be a man who's over 100 years old living in a modern day world. And I think that because we've already seen some of that with Captain America, there's not a whole lot to distinguish what makes this plotline interesting, at least in the pilot. That could all change over the life of the series. And right now I think the Sam stuff is a bit more interesting because we haven't seen something like that. But either way, I'm really intrigued by the premise more than I thought it was going to be. There's some great action choreography and setups by director Kari Skoglund, who is, again, another female filmmaker helming a series like this. So it's worth a watch.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely looking forward to it. It's going to be, you know, appointment TV for my family again. The trailers and such really seem to be playing up this kind of butting heads dynamic between Sam and Bucky. I mean, is that, do you think, a strong element here of this that's going to continue, or what's the deal with that?
Right now, it's unknown because it's not explained in the pilot. They're on very separate paths at the moment. So I haven't figured out where these two were going to coincide. So I can't answer that right now.
Well, and you know what you were saying about a few things there. I mean, you know, WandaVision was kind of a slow burn with the first couple of episodes. So being in the dark about a few things, you know, from the pilot and such, that wouldn't surprise me, you know, given the way the other series has gone.
Exactly. I mean, I think that this is a very different series. It's far more, it's something that we've seen, you know. Mm-hmm. So we've seen Marvel do action. It doesn't have the unique gimmick of WandaVision. So I think it's definitely more in line for people that want that MCU connection that they were missing in WandaVision.
Sure, absolutely. All right, well, let's move on to a few other things here. We got our first trailer for Luca, the next Pixar film. And so let's share a few thoughts on that. I got to say that I kind of watched it just at the perfect time because, you know, I know it came out a few days back, but I only just watched it today in a break between, you know, adventures outside shoveling the 2 feet of snow we're getting here in Denver right now. So to see this, you know, this very beautiful, you know, Riviera setting on there, you're just kind of going, okay, and now back out to the snow. But anyway, what are your thoughts on this trailer, Kristen?
I mean, I definitely think it's beautiful. I'm into the premise, which is a coming-of-age story about a boy living in Italy whose best friend is a sea monster.
Yeah, that was new. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the director has talked about how there's a personal connection to himself, which could be really interesting to see. But I thought this was a decent teaser. I mean, it's only about a minute and a half. I'm still kind of surprised that it's not some sort of weird Call Me By Your Name continuation, considering everything about it. But I'm interested. I'm into it.
I'm certainly interested, but it did throw me as I was watching it because I was really taking in the look of the film and, you know, thought it looked beautiful and the design of these characters. I thought it was a very different type of look for human characters than what Pixar has done. And then suddenly they're turning into like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And I was like, what? What is this all about? And I don't know. There's a part of me that goes, all right, that's interesting. But I'm also a little worried because, like, there's been a few of those other kinds of, like, I don't know, weird out of left field things that Pixar has put in some of their films that I haven't been as on board with, you know, like with Soul, when we talked about that, you know, you see all the trailers and the look of it. And I kind of had an idea in my head of what it was all about. And then we have this body swapping thing with a cat. And I was like, wait a second, where did this come from? So the sea monsters thing just completely threw me. And I'm going, okay, Pixar, don't just, you know, cause me to abandon things midway through the movie again. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think Disney, you know, we know that they're high concept and they like to have some type of weird moment that makes you say, huh, there has to be some sort of fantastical element. And Soul, I don't think it worked as well, but I think if we already have a high concept kind of magical realism type of thing, almost like what we did with Coco.
Sure.
It could work.
And I do think as I watched this trailer, I was definitely getting more of that kind of feel like Coco had. So yeah, that I would say is promising. All right, one last bit of news here. We talked last time about just a little bit of casting news on Pinocchio, the live action CGI hybrid thing that Robert Zemeckis is doing for Disney Plus. We've had some more casting news here. Cynthia Erivo is been cast as the Blue Fairy, and then Joseph Gordon-Levitt has been cast as Jiminy Cricket. I don't know if this is he's going to be doing, you know, a CGI version of Jiminy Cricket, or if he's, you know, going to be like made up to look like a cricket. I don't know. You know, the first thing I thought is, what kind of weird voice is Joseph Gordon-Levitt going to do as Jiminy Cricket? Because he loves weird voices, you know.
I hate it.
Well, we already know you're down on this project to start with. So
I don't hate the Cynthia Erivo. I mean, anytime you get Cynthia Erivo, it's great. I love her. I think she's great. The Joseph Gordon-Levitt thing is what's throwing me. Like, why? I don't get. And when I hear his name, I get nothing. I'm sorry. So yeah, it's just. It's a weird, I think it's something that we've talked about before with Disney's casting more for name than for talent. And I just keep thinking of, like, The Lion King, you know? Like, in certain instances, that was a great unity of character and voice, like Billy Eichner. And then you also get, like, character and voice where it adds nothing distinctive.
Yeah.
Like,
John Oliver. I did not like John Oliver in that version at all. I was like,
she was so edgy for or something where you have a person who's a good actor, but just their voice brought nothing to the project. So I get that here. And he's also, I mean, if we're going to keep the movie, I mean, he's also got to sing When You Wish Upon a Star, and I want to hear Joseph Gordon-Levitt sing that.
Does he sing? I don't even. I was trying to remember if he's sung in anything.
I remember him doing Make 'Em Laugh on SNL. So, and he's been attached for a long time to an adaptation of Guys and Dolls. So, yes.
I remembered the there's that musical number in what's that movie? The 500 Days of Summer. You know, but that's lip synced. Yeah. So. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, this is one of the weirder projects on the slate. So, yeah, we'll see what happens with that. All right. Well, that's all the news we have this time. Let's talk about a short.
Who's got the sweetest disposition? One guess who? Who never starts an argument? Who never shows a bit of temperament? Who's never wrong but always right? Who'd never dream of starting a fight? Who gets stuck with all the bad luck? No one but Donald Duck.
So our short this week is a Donald Duck short. It feels like it's been a while since we did a Donald Duck short, or it could have just been because of how long it's been since recording.
That happens, yeah.
We are talking about 1948's Inferior Decorator. This is a short featuring Donald Duck and his nemesis Spike the Bee, who does not get nearly enough love in the grand canon of Disney characters.
He was in quite a few of the shorts, though. I was looking it up on like a Disney fan Wikipedia type of thing, and he's got about a dozen or so appearances.
Yeah, I remember him in various ones. Again, very similar to Chip and Dale, or any of the numerous foils from nature that Donald Duck butts heads with. But Spike is pollinating the flowers outside of Donald's house, and he mistakes the wallpaper that Donald is putting up in the house for actual flowers, and Donald decides to run with it by getting Spike stuck in glue, and then he pushes him outside and shuts the window. But Spike gets his revenge by removing the key from the lock and stinging Donald in the butt, only to get caught in the wallpaper glue, and a fight between Bee and Duck and wallpaper ensues. But I want to say that I had seen this probably, you know, when they used to show these shorts in the mornings, and I thought this was a lot of fun. I think it's a great, colorful short. It's directed by longtime animator Jack Hanna, and it's a really good encapsulation of why Donald shorts tend to work so well.
I agree. I think this is a very fun, clever, short little Donald film. You know, it's not terribly deep, but it does what it needs to do. You know, there's a lot of good physical comedy going on, and I think that the bee makes for a good nemesis for Donald. I think in a lot of ways, a bit better than like Chip and Dale, because with Chip and Dale, I mean, we've talked about our frustrations with them. You know, there are times when they're enjoyable, that there are times when they're annoying. And I don't know. I think that with the bee, there's almost like we're almost like on an equal playing field here with Donald. There were times when Donald gets his comeuppance and you think, well, he deserved it. There were also times when the bee got his comeuppance and I thought, well, he deserved it too. You know, I think they're kind of equally matched here. And that was kind of refreshing.
I mean, Donald as a character is one that is quick to madden, right, as we've seen. And having a bee, a character that is already associated with anger, you know, with the stings and everything, I think that they're rather evenly matched. And it also has a premise that is just fleshed out enough to work, which is that they're both unified by flowers, and Spike is upset that the flower is not real in Donald's house, which causes them to kind of be at each other's throats. And just as soon as that premise runs out of steam, it ends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think there's, you know, there is a lot of fun and playfulness with the whole the wallpapering aspect of things. I think they actually could have done a little bit more with it.
Yeah.
You know, and actually a part of me thought that, you know, you could have just done a whole short that was Donald getting frustrated with wallpapering his house. You don't even need the bee, because that's, I mean, I would never want to do that. I know that's a challenging thing. And I'm thinking, hey, Donald wallpapering his house, that's a disaster waiting to happen. But as it is, you know, using that along with the bee, I think works just fine here. And there's a lot of good sight gags that they do with, like the bee getting caught in the glue, or when Donald, you know, ends up getting his hands caught in the wallpaper that gets stuck to the ceiling. So he's left hanging there, you know, kind of, you know, just waiting for the bee to come and sting him. Yeah, that's clever stuff. There's a lot of good gags in this one. And, you know, we've talked about it before that the Disney shorts, though they excel at the animation, aren't always the best with the gags. You know, I would have looked to, you know, the Looney Tunes or the Fleischers to be stronger on the physical comedy. This is one that's got some good physical comedy to it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of really great physical comedy that doesn't feel out of the realm of possibility. You know, it's not a lot of weird theatrics where you're just like, how does that physically work? There's a lot of great stuff with Spike and his stinger. You know, where he's using it to cut things. I also really appreciated the use of Technicolor.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
It's very beautiful, whether that's the flowers outside or even just the ugly wallpaper inside, that there is this bright sense of color. And
yeah,
depth.
The first shot of the film is, you know, this look at Donald's house, and there's all these flowers outside, which the first thing I thought is like, wow, Donald is quite the gardener. I would kill all those things instantly because I can't make anything grow. You know, the first shot is just gorgeous with all these flowers. It made me think of, you know, the flowers that sing and all that in like Alice in Wonderland, which is, you know, a different style of animation than this. But I just thought how realistic and, you know, the way the colors just pop on those flowers. I was like, wow, that's really something. I mean, just for a 7-minute little Donald Duck short, that's some amazing artwork there.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really surprised. I mean, I could just imagine seeing this in a theater. You know, we just talked about, I just did a podcast episode where we talked about The Three Musketeers from 1948 and that film's use of Technicolor. And, you know, seeing it in a short, you know, it really does show you how Technicolor just gives off a different vibe than anything else.
Yeah. One last thing I wanted to throw out on the look of things with this character, Spike the Bee. I'm looking at him the whole time and going, you know what? This guy looks like he's modeled on Mickey Mouse, the look of him. I you know, as I started to break it down,
I saw a lot of Marvin the Martian almost.
Well, when I looked at his face and just kind of the way his nose and eyes are and the shape of his head, I thought it's Mickey, but without the ears. He's got antenna instead. And instead of a tail, he's got a stinger, you know, which I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting look. All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our look at Frida.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
What if I told you that easel painting like yours is finished? That it's headed for the trash like other elitist bourgeois pastimes?
I'd say cut the propaganda.
Yeah, this is very good work. You have real talent.
Oh, come on. I'm not looking for your compliment. I want a serious critique.
But I'm being sincere. These are very original paintings. None of the usual tricks.
But that's not specific.
You have to trust a true compliment as much as a critique.
Yeah, well, some people have told me not to trust what you say. They say if a girl asks your opinion and she's not a complete fright, you'll gush all over her. I need you to tell me one thing, honestly. Do you actually believe that I should continue to paint?
Yes. Yes.
So our feature film this time comes from 2002, back when Miramax was in the under the umbrella of Disney. This is Frida, the biopic of painter Frida Kahlo. It's directed by Julie Taymor, who, of course, had a bit of a history at this point. She was first and foremost a theatrical director who really kind of hit it big and became a name that Disney fans knew when she directed the stage version of The Lion King in 1997. And then eventually she turned her attention to movies and has done some interesting films. She first did Titus in 1999. This then was her second film. After this, did Across the Universe, which I have a real sweet spot for that bizarre, wonderful movie. and then she had a film just last year called The Glorias, which I think was on Amazon. But this, of course, stars Selma Hayek, and it was a bit of a passion project for her. She served as producer on this as well. You've also got Alfred Molina in the big, kind of secondary role here in this film as Kahlo's husband. And, this is a film that, was kind of being eyed a lot at awards time that year. It did get a bit of recognition. I was very surprised, though, when at the end of our last show, Kristen said she had not seen this before, because I thought, this just seems like a Kristen kind of movie.
No, it's interesting, because Julie Taymor is a director that I feel like I should see everything that she does, but I haven't. This is actually, I think, looking at the filmography, the second thing of hers I've seen. Because I love Across the Universe, and I have to see The Tempest, which she did an adaptation of The Tempest a couple of years after Across the Universe. So I need to see that, because it's got David Strathairn in it, which is kind of my thing this year, to see everything he's been in.
Well, yeah, that's never a bad
thing. It's never a bad thing. It's a great thing. He's not in this movie, though, which is upsetting. But no, I'd never seen Frida. I remember when it came out. I remember the comments that were made about Salma Hayek not being hot. And I remember a lot of the discussion about how I learned about this movie more from, I think, predominantly men talking about it, because Salma Hayek, I mean, in 2002 was kind of transitioning as an actress, because I think a lot of people had always perceived her as the hot, fiery Latina, which she did, she was for a time, but as she started to get older, she had been doing a lot more movies to kind of show that she could act. and this was one of many, and this was her big chance to show people that she had talent, that she was more than just being a beautiful woman. And I think that the Oscars tend to be a real fickle mistress in that we have a history of women having to downplay their looks in order to win an Oscar. It's called uglying up. Look at The Country Girl and Grace Kelly as prime example. And this movie got a lot of flack for that in terms of like, oh, Salma Hayek gets a unibrow and she wants an Oscar. And I think that really did work against her in a lot of ways, but that's, you know, us being sucky as a society. But I was really happy to finally get to cross this off the list. And it's a weird sit. And I think maybe if I had seen this before I knew how hard it was for Salma Hayek to make it, especially because of what Harvey Weinstein forced her to endure in order to get it out. So I just kept watching it being like, God, you can see the things that he forced her to do, the things that he forced to be in this movie. We could talk about that. But
oh, yeah.
I kind of almost wish that I had seen this before I knew that, because it's hard to divorce yourself from that.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely dig into some of the behind-the-scenes difficulties with this film. But give us the lowdown on the basics of what this is about, kind of the course that it follows, and then we'll dig into it.
Yeah, so this is, as Todd mentioned, a biopic of Frida Kahlo, starting with the accident she suffered at the age of 18 when she was in a trolley crash that caused her to sustain a lot of injuries that would plague her for the rest of her life. She decides she wants to be a painter and meets Diego Rivera, played by Alfred Molina. The two have this very tempestuous relationship where he cannot be faithful to her. They also want to establish both of them. They want to establish themselves as artists. They travel to New York, but their communist connections end up working against them. And eventually we see Frida come into her own as a painter and the issues she has in her personal life.
So this is a film that I saw many years ago, probably a year or so after it came out, and hadn't seen since then. So my memories of it were pretty vague. Watching this just a few days ago, it was interesting just to take it in light of another episode that we've done in the last year or so. And that was when we talked about What's Love Got to Do with It. I thought, you could definitely draw a few comparisons with the way that this film is structured in terms of, you know, dealing with a couple and this, you know, kind of unique relationship that the two have, and the weight that's given to each of the two characters, and kind of wondering if the film is really giving the proper amount of time and attention to the character whose name is the title of the film. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you bring up What's Love Got to Do with It, because when this was going through its very troubled production that started in the 1980s, at one point they did approach Brian Gibson, who had directed What's Love Got to Do with It, to make this movie. But, and I mean, maybe that's part of what we should bring up, is that this movie always started out as a story of both Rivera and Kahlo, because it was often hard to tell one story without the other because they were so intertwined. And I did, watching it now, maybe also because I've been watching a lot of Marilyn Monroe movies for a project I'm doing, I was really struck by this being this movie where it's about Frida and her troubled personal life. You know, oh, she's a great painter, but she can't keep her husband from being faithful. You know, we have to kind of go into that trap of the woman who is a professional genius can't keep her relationships going. And the movie really tries to balance out Rivera's issues with her own relationships with men and with women, which I think it says a lot about how this movie was marketed, and that I assumed that there was far more same-sex relationships going on in this movie. I was just like, oh, okay, so it's not really the thing. Like, it's not what we're focusing on. And I was kind of struck that I thought that that's what it was about, and I think that's because people that had seen it were kind of thinking that that's what it was about. But I was a little, you know, irked by seeing sequences of her crying over Diego Rivera being a notorious womanizer. When the movie starts, with him cheating on his wife and her seeing it, his first wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that the movie has a tall order to fill because it has to showcase her as a painter, him as a painter, their relationship, and then Tamer's use of puppetry and color and all the things that she loves to include in her films. So there's a lot to deconstruct in 2 hours. But I do think that this might have worked a little bit better by focusing more on her as the painter. I mean, don't get me wrong, so much of her painting was because of her relationship with Rivera, because of wanting to be a mother. And I do think the movie does a decent job, but it is both a co-production. It should be called Rivera and Kahlo, which Frida and Diego was originally what it was titled in 92, and it almost got off the ground.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would even say there are times in this film where you're almost going, this should almost more accurately be called Diego. Because I would say the first two-thirds of the movie, there are moments where you almost forget that Frida is supposedly the central character of this. You know, I kind of get it. I mean, like you say, the two are intertwined no matter what. You can't tell one story without the other. But I think the film does struggle a bit to really help the audience to understand kind of what drives Frida's work as her life continues. I mean, a lot of the film, she's very much kind of taking a back seat and saying, well, I'm not as good as he is, and I don't want to show what I'm doing here. I just do this for myself type of a thing. And I think that there are moments where the film tries to explore the things that are driving her, and specifically the pain that she experienced throughout her whole life. I mean, you know, not just pain as a concept, but actual physical pain. I don't know. There are times where it just kind of glosses over that. And I think it could have gone a bit deeper to help us really understand what she was going through.
I think this movie has a real hard time talking about her as a Latina, which, you know, there's a lot going on in this movie about the political elements of her being a Latina and living in Mexico in the 1930s into the 1940s, as you're having revolution and a lot of what was going on with painting at that time. And that could be because only one Latino actually had any hand in this script. This was predominantly written by white Americans, including Edward Norton, who did a pass on the script at one time.
And I was going to say, I'm trying to remember, wasn't Norton in a relationship with Hayek at the time?
Yes, and part of getting the movie greenlit was her kind of convincing a lot of her friends to make appearances in this movie, and so he does have a small role as Nelson Rockefeller, of all people. But the script is credited to Clancy Sybil, who did In Love and War with the Chris O'Donnell, Sandra Bullock movie. Diane Lake, who this is her only credit. Anna Thompson, who is a German woman who had worked on films like El Norte. And Gregory Nava also worked on this script. He is the only Latino best known for writing Selena, the biopic of Selena with Jennifer Lopez. And you have, again, an American white director. You know, there is it's really hard to, I think, navigate the political claims of this movie. You know, the fact that Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera were hanging out with Trotsky, you know.
More than hanging out.
Or that Rivera's Man at the Crossroads, the mural he did for Rockefeller in Rockefeller Center, had a picture of Vladimir Lenin. I mean, the movie doesn't really showcase why these people and why Mexico in general was really gravitating to what was going on with communism at that time. It's something that as Americans we're told, you know, bad. This was a time of fear. And so I think it loses a lot in focusing on the political aims of Frida and Diego and losing the element of why they were so revered and why as Latin Americans, their work is still so captivating. I mean, when Frida Kahlo's work went up for auction, you know, it was the most money ever paid for a Latin American artist. And that's important because Latin American artists are, you know, not common historically. And I think the movie doesn't really know how to emphasize why Frida's Mexicanness was vital.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're absolutely right there that the political angle of this film, which is significant. I mean, the politics takes up quite a bit of the film, but yeah, it totally lacks context. Watching this, you just figured that, oh, you know, Diego is, you know, just, he's out there. He's a radical, he's, you know, whatever. Also though, the whole time watching it, I in some ways didn't buy his viewpoints. In a lot of ways, I think the way it's presented, you know, it comes across as like, you know, his politics are a fashion accessory for him, you know?
Right. The movie makes a big deal about Rivera being this painter for money. You know, he doesn't have any artistic integrity. He's willing to paint for his wealthy friends. And so when he does do Man at the Crossroads and refuses to compromise on the Lenin portrait, it almost feels like it's not a personal principle, but like he's remembering all these people that said that he's a sellout. So he doesn't want to sell out. And, you know, I think you also lose the fact that as a Mexican man, so that dictates so much of the relationship between the two, why Frida would sublimate herself and her talent to keep him happy. Why, as a Mexican man, he feels that he can cheat, you know, as flagrantly as he does. The movie really wants to ignore their ethnicity. And this is 2002, you know, there was a lot going on in terms of this belief that, you know, we didn't really need to focus on color, you know, we're the belief that we're post-racial. And so it is a very white, in many ways, whitewashed look at Frida Kahlo's life. And I think that also comes through clearly when you're looking at some of the casting that was considered before this and in the movie itself. You know, Valeria Golino, who plays Lupe, who is Diego's first wife, I really liked her character. I think that her and Salma Hayek have a great relationship, considering, you know, she's the ex-wife. Frida is the current wife.
And I like her a lot. I think I always struggle with her name. Valeria Golino is an underrated actor. I consistently, when she shows up in things, enjoy what she brings.
Yeah, she's great. I think there's a great storyline there, but it was really hard for me to watch it in these times and for remember that she's Italian. Mm-hmm. And she's not Latina, you know, or Ashley Judd, who I could not for the life of me. Did they specify what she is supposed to be ethnicity wise?
I Italian? Don't think so. Yeah.
Is she Latina? Because they darken up her skin and she has an accent, which was very distracting.
Just clicking on the I've got the Wikipedia page up here, and of course this is an actual person she plays, says she was an Italian American photographer. So
okay, so it's a little bit better. They still darken her skin up, but you know, okay. When you look at, I think that the thing that I noticed, and I went through the production history, and as soon as I saw this, I realized exactly my issue. I think this is a better version, but I realized my issue. Todd, are you ready?
Okay.
I read that Madonna announced her plans to make a film based on Frida Kahlo's life. I do not know if it was before or after Evita, exactly what I kept saying. I'm like, oh, this is Evita. It's just a little more Mexican.
She had this whole fascination with, you know, Latin American stuff. I mean, a number of her albums back in the late 80s and such have that feel to them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, when we did the episode on Evita, I said I liked Evita, though, you know, Madonna was not Argentinian. And I think that this movie is a bit more nuanced than Evita. But at the same time, it's very much similar to Evita in showing kind of the glitz of Frida's life. And by that, I mean the concept of her being this great genius. The other comparison I kept seeing was A Beautiful Mind, which came out relatively close to this as well, in that it is this story of genius. And look at how similar that is. Look at how beautiful that is. And I feel that emphasis on the beauty of genius and the torture of being a genius just ends up feeling kind of generic.
I understand what you're saying there. I mean, one thing I wanted to talk about was just the look of the film. I think the film looks beautiful, but that came to mind when you were just saying those things there, because I'm going, well, I mean, is that an example of, did they pretty this up too much? You know what I mean? Was it really, you know, like you were saying, that attempt to really make this all look very exotic and beautiful?
It kind of is, now that you bring it up, because, you know, I've written about Frida Kahlo's work, you know, from a point. I mean, she is a disabled artist, and that's often forgotten. She suffered this horrible, horrible trauma in this trolley crash and was in constant pain every day, spent significant parts of her life in a body cast, confined to a bed. And I think that what I was surprised by, and yet at the same time not surprised by, because it's 2002, is how much this movie does not want to be a disability narrative. It's more about Frida overcoming that. But so much of her work was influenced by being disabled. And I really felt that was a disservice. And that's the thing. Her work is not beautiful in the sense of it looking like Starry Night. It was filled with trauma and pain and twisted, contorted bodies. It's grotesque, but there's a beauty in that grotesquerie.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking exactly. Is you look at a Frida Kahlo painting, and you know, you look at it in one moment, and you go, "Wow, that's really beautiful." And then you let your eyes shift a little bit, and you go, "Wow, that's horrifying." You know,
right? And I think that Tamer is probably the best person to showcase that artistry, but she focuses more on the beauty and less on the grotesquerie. I mean, I did like the thing that she does where it'll be a painting that then transforms into live, you know, like that scene after Diego and Frida are married, and it transitions from them the painting of them together, and then transitions into them standing in their wedding banquet. But I was really, really turned off by, you know, she's in a body cast at 18 for what seems to be maybe a couple months. And then we have a big, you know, I can walk sequence. Mm. But she keeps talking about the emphasis on the pain and the surgeries. And I think, you know, somebody who's looked at Frida Kahlo's paintings, the movie would have been about those surgeries and that horror.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie has really no problem, you know, when she loses a child, you know, showing a fetus in a jar, which did, again, inform her artwork. But I think the movie really does want to be, you know, it does want to turn off an audience, you know. So it does want to emphasize these are different, you know, maybe not beautiful, but different.
Well, see, even in the moment where she has that, you know, the miscarriage and all that, I thought, this is a defining moment. This is something that feels like there should be more weight to it than what they give it here, because it goes very quickly from her and Diego discussing, you know, let's have a child. The next thing we know, we're in a hospital and we're panicked. It just seems to me like there's very little opportunity for us to really dig deep into what that did to affect her, to affect her work.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that really does a bit of a disservice by emphasizing the relationships that she needed to dull the pain from Diego, or her relationship with Trotsky that ends up actually destroying her marriage. You know, I would have liked a bit more of how the sense of confinement affected her, because it seemed to affect her a lot more.
Well, and I mean, the Trotsky thing, I mean, do you think the film puts more weight on something like that? Because, you know, it's titillating. It's, you know what I mean?
I was really concerned. Like, I think all the relationships in this movie, aside from Rivera, obviously, feel very transitory. You know, the relationship, there's a lot of just kind of weird one night stands, you know, where Saffron Burroughs has a cameo as this girl that both Diego and Frida have slept with. You know, there's the Josephine Baker sex scene, which is the big full nudity lesbian sex scene that Harvey Weinstein demanded they put in the movie. But then the Trotsky stuff, I was really not clear on what drew, it's Jeffrey Rush for starters, you know. I was really unclear in what attracted her to him,
exactly,
other than maybe the connection to Diego knowing how he felt about Trotsky.
Yeah.
You know, so these relationships often feel like they're ill-defined, and it really does in some cases make me believe that this movie kind of falls into the stereotypes of, like, saucy Latina that's going to sleep with everybody type of thing.
Real quick, before we kind of, I want to touch on real quick your thoughts on, you know, our two lead performances and such, because one of these is an Oscar nominated performance. But,
yeah.
You know, we talked a little bit about the visuals. I wanted to throw out there, I do appreciate, you know, what a director like Julie Taymor brings when it comes to, you know, that element you were talking about, kind of the bringing the paintings to life. I think that was great. There are a few other moments in this where I think she does some things that just had me scratching my head. There is this animated sequence that's very early in the film after the accident where we have, like, you know, we portray the doctors that are working on her as these strange skeletons, and you know, this is a short little animated segment that just really took me out of things for a few moments, and I thought just felt really out of place. And then just the strangest moment of this film is where she goes to see King Kong, and we have this whole, you know, fantasy sequence where she's picturing Alfred Molina, Diego, as King Kong, standing on the top of the Empire State Building, pounding his chest and swatting at airplanes and such.
I thought they're very Taymor.
Yes.
You know, they're sequences like that that pop up and across the universe, so I expected them. You know, I do think that they get the closest to, I think the first one especially is the closest to getting into Kahlo's mind and mimicking her work in a way that's original, you know, and showing the horrors of this accident. The King Kong stuff, you know, it does emphasize a lot of the nuance that probably would have been conveyed through dialogue, you know, in the sense that Diego wants to take over New York, you know, he wants to be a part of it, but he can't. So he gets beaten down by the man, so to speak, when Rockefeller tells him that they're not going to let him continue working on the mural. So they're pretty on the nose, but it makes sense from, you know, the Taymor element of it.
All right. Well, let's talk about the performances here. You know, we've got, I mean, we always think of Salma Hayek on this because, you know, she's the title character and such, but Alfred Molina's role is just as big. You know, it's very much like what the dynamic we had, you know, talk about What's Love Got to Do With It, where we had two actors, you know, that were at the center of the story, even though it's supposedly focusing more on one. And I don't know, what's your take on these performances here?
I mean, they're probably the best we would have gotten at the time. And that probably does a disservice to both of them, because I think, you know, Alfred Molina is really good in this movie. You know, his dad is Spanish, which, I mean, technically is white, but, you know, it's better than we could have gotten. I think he does do a lot in terms of conveying the self-esteem issues that Rivera had. You know, Frida does comment on his weight a lot, and, you know, a lot of that, I think, did foster his need to kind of plant his flag with a lot of ladies. But and you really do get kind of how pathetic he is in some instances. You know, their relationship is built on lies on so many levels. You know, he's pretty open with her about how he's never going to be faithful, but he doesn't really support his wife in a lot of ways, to the point that he's, you know, willing to bed her sister just because he can. So there's a lot of entitlement, I think, that the movie doesn't really explore, but that in the era of discussing kind of male privilege, we now see as the fact that, you know, it's just because he can, as a dude, that he might as well. I think Salma Hayek, though, does some of the best work of her career. It's a shame she didn't win the Oscar. I would like to remind everybody that no Latina has ever won best lead role ever in the Oscars. And if you're sitting in your room saying Rita Moreno supporting, So, and when you look at the actress lineup that year, which was Diane Lane for Unfaithful, Julianne Moore for Far From Heaven, Renee Zellweger for Chicago, Nicole Kidman for The Hours, it's a pretty great year. But Salma, I think, really does give a performance. And I think that this was a year that the beauty standard really did play into things. Because I remember Nicole Kidman, what did we all say? She had a fake nose and she won an Oscar. Exactly. So I feel like it was really a contest of who was going to do more to their appearance. And that really does belittle the talent.
Well, and who won the following year? Do you remember? I've got it here in front of me. You're talking about appearance.
No.
Charlize Theron in Monster.
Monster? Oh, God, yeah. But, I mean, again, I think Charlize gave a good – that's a dynamite performance.
Oh, yeah.
I think I would have loved to have seen Salma Hayek get an Oscar for this. You know, she did go back and do some more commercial films, but I would have loved to have seen her. I'd love to see her get a role like this again, because I think she does a really great job.
Yeah.
I will go through briefly the production, because let's talk about who we could have had instead of Salma. So this was originally started in the 1980s with the talk of making this into a movie based off of Hayden Herrera's biography, Kahlo. They optioned it in 88 and wanted to sell it as a, quote, epic love story, the tradition of Out of Africa. And they originally had Meryl Streep and Jessica Lange audition for this Mexican painter. and then that didn't happen. Madonna announced that she wanted to make a movie based on Frida's life. And then in 91, they actually approached director Luis Valdez, who is a Chicano playwright, began production on a film with Laura San Giacomo in the lead. And people got upset because she's not Latina. And they actually abandoned the film in 92, citing that it was financially unfeasible. And then a bunch of people tried to bring together some Frida stories. And that's when Salma Hayek brought up her interest in it, but they said she was too young. And in 93, they had retitled the film with Laura San Giacomo and Ophelia Medina, I guess, playing the Latina version. I don't know how that was going to work out. And they had Raul Julia cast as Diego Rivera, but unfortunately he died, and they didn't make the movie. So there was a lot going back and forth, and Salma Hayek really did champion wanting to make this movie, to the point that she actually sought out a lover of Diego Rivera's who actually owns the rights to Frida and Rivera's art. And Salma Hayek was the one to approach Alfred Molina and try to get all of these other people, and she went to Weinstein and Miramax and got the film made. So, I mean, Salma Hayek single-handedly put this film together.
Now, we did say that there's a lot of stuff that has come to light in recent years about this. We've kind of hinted at some of it, but yeah, let's dig into that. It's, you know, not a pleasant subject, but we should talk about it.
There's a great op-ed, I think, in the New York Times. You can probably still find it, that Salma Hayek did in the wake of the Me Too thing and the knowledge about Harvey Weinstein being a sexual predator. And she had mentioned that he attempted to shut this film down several times, that he didn't get it. He didn't care. You know, he thought Frida Kahlo was an ugly woman, and he really did not want to make this movie happen. He threatened to fire Salma Hayek numerous times and replace her with another actress. She claims because she refused to have sex with him. And he threatened to shut down the film unless in the 11th hour she agreed to film a full frontal nude sex scene with herself and another woman, which is in the film. It is as out of place as you would expect it to be. He claims that none of that's true. It's okay, but it's really hard to watch, you know, how much, there's not a whole lot of nudity, and I think that that's the thing, is that this movie is about artists, you know, so you expect some nudity to pop up here and there, and there are some love scenes that are pretty tastefully filmed, you know, up until that Josephine Baker sex scene where you're just like, what happened here? Like, we took a real sharp turn into, like, naked, and it's just really out of place. Like, I don't know about Utah, but I mean, for a movie that's 2 hours, this comes about, I think, 90 minutes into the film, and you know, the nudity was like something I expected it again, and up until this point it was rather tastefully shot. But I saw that and I was just like, oh, that's the scene.
Yeah.
It sticks out.
Yeah, well, and there's also a moment earlier in the film where she has been with her boyfriend, who is Oh, who plays the boyfriend? Oh, Diego Luna, right?
Diego Luna, yeah. That was, I think, like his first movie.
Yeah. And, you know, she kind of, you know, is running out of a room and, you know, very quickly is, you know, undressed and pulls her clothes on over it. So, you know, it's like a, you know, a brief glimpse. But again, you look at it and you go, wow, that's out of place. You know what I mean? It's just, it seemed like somebody said, oh, well, we got to have some nudity here. You know what I mean? You got to have the big star get naked.
That didn't strike me because it, in the context of the sequence, you know, they're young kids. She's supposed to be 18. And, you know, it's kind of like it's some side boob. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, it's her frantically getting dressed. So that seemed a bit more naturalistic to the plot. Or at least the sequence. I don't want to say the plot, but to the sequence, you know. And I think that too. That's the other thing, you know. Seeing Ashley Judd in this movie, who also was famously blackballed by Weinstein, you know. And there's a romantic tango sequence that they do, which is very intimate. It's very beautifully filmed. But seeing both of them, and you know, kind of knowing the hell that they were going through, it really does kind of like make you sit back and say, like, ugh. This movie.
Well, and you know, you mentioned Ashley Judd there too. Made me think. There's actually some other big names in this we haven't met. Antonio Banderas shows up for a few moments
for a sequence. Yeah, which I think that both of them were connected because of the Robert Rodriguez movies. Like, you can see Salma Hayek kind of going and asking her friends, like, you doing anything this weekend?
Cashing in her
chips. You want to film this movie? And I mean, I thought that Edward Norton was out of place, but he wasn't horrifically out of place. You know, I did think it was funny knowing the Evita comparisons and seeing Antonio Banderas in this movie. I think the biggest shock for me was seeing, like, Mia Maestro has a really big role as Frida Kahlo's sister in I Love Tron Alias, so it was great to see her in this movie. If we want to talk about Oscars briefly, especially as this is the week of Oscar nominations, this movie did win two, Best Original Score and Best Makeup, I'm assuming for the unibrow. Mm-hmm. But it was also nominated for Best Original Song, Best Costume Design, Art Direction, and Salma Hayek, which, again, I would have given her the Oscar. I would have also nominated Alfred Molina.
I would have, too, he
would have been good. I don't know if he would have won, because people really liked The Pianist. God, 2002 was not a good year.
It's the year of Chicago. Chicago won Best Picture, right?
It's the year of Chicago. It's also the year Roman Polanski won Best Director. I do want to say costume design, which I would have thought this movie would have won with a bullet. It did not win. Chicago won.
Yeah.
I get it. I don't know. I feel very I say this as somebody that loves Disney. Also, I mean, Chicago, or it's a Miramax as well. So really, Disney was just competing with itself.
Oh, yeah. We did an episode on it many, many moons ago. So, yeah.
I'm waiting for Chicago to give Frida the what is it? Like, did you see that this week with Avengers Endgame handing over the reins because Avatar is now again the highest grossing film of all time because it got re-released in theaters.
Yeah, it's just Disney patting itself on the back, going back and forth. Yep. Well, and we should talk box office here. How did this do at the box office? I mean, it's not a blockbuster type of film.
No. So this came out in October of 2002 in the U.S. after having a Venice Film Festival premiere in August. But it did gross $25.9 million in the U.S. Off of a budget of about $12 million, which is pretty good. It made about $56.3 million total. It was initially, it did a pretty good rollout. And then by late December of 2002, it had earned over $20 million in just almost 300 theaters. It does have a 75% on Rotten Tomatoes. Most people liked it. You know, they did think that the movie kind of pulls its punches, you know, that it is a very glossy feature, although Roger Ebert Really enjoyed it. He gave it 3.5 stars. I'm trying to see if anybody had bad things to say, but I cannot seem to find one, at least on Wikipedia. I'm sure there were negative reviews. So, yeah.
I mean, it's a movie that, I don't know, kind of rewatching this time, I thought, well, you know, it's fine. You know, I mean, it's a biopic. I enjoy biopics for the most part, you know, especially if it's a particularly intriguing subject matter. But, you know, it's one of those where I watch and I go, well, I guess you're hitting the obligatory things here. There's some good things going on. You know, there's some good performances, but it's not giving me that extra punch that really makes a biopic stand out for me.
It's a very 2002 biopic. You know, I think that's the thing. But I am happy I finally got to see it. I think that really you're watching this to see Salma Hayek in what should have been an Oscar-winning performance.
All right, well, let's talk about some pins here. So if there were pins based on the movie Frida down at the Disney store, what would you be looking for?
The Disney stores are closing, Todd. They're closing my Disney store in Sacramento.
Okay.
So, no.
I haven't looked to see if they're closing mine at my mall yet, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know. So.
Obviously, I would do, you know, Frida's face. If I could just do the unibrow, that would be
Yeah, cool. I was going to say. Can we just do the unibrow?
That would be really, really cool. Frida in the bed, which is such an evocative image of her in her painting. So I would include that. And I'd also include the mural, the Man at the Crossroads that Rivera did not get to keep. So those would be mine.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, there's you know, a dozen or so images from the various paintings that you could certainly do. You know, that one image that you mentioned where it kind of morphs from the painting to live action of them at the wedding. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, or there's that image of the dress hanging on the line, something like that. And then the other thing I had down, just because it's so ridiculous, is Alfred Molina as King Kong.
Yes, definitely.
All right. So what are you going to rate Frida on our scale of 5 Mickey heads?
I gave this a 3. I liked it. I don't know if I'd watch it again. It's not my favorite Tamor. Across the Universe still wins. But hey, maybe I'll watch The Tempest and that'll, you know, be my favorite. So yeah, this is a solid 3 for me.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I was thinking a 3 as well. It's you know, it's a good film, some good performances, just not stellar, you know. So yeah. And beautiful to look at, for sure. No question about that. So, all right, well, that's going to do it for our look at Frida. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this film or any of the other films that we've talked about. Please feel free to email us at waltsentmepodcast@gmail.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter @waltsentmepod or on Facebook, which is where?
Facebook.com/waltsentmepod.
And Kristen, as usual, please tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter @journeys_film. I also do a classic film podcast called Ticklish Business, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, wherever you get your shows.
And as for me, you can follow me on Twitter @ForgottenFilms. That's films with a Z. My blog is called Forgotten Films. It's @ForgottenFilmcast.wordpress.com. And that's also where you'll find links to my other podcast, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast. All right. So what is the movie we're going to be looking at next time?
We're going back to the Disney animated features. Yes, we still have ones we haven't talked about. We are going from the world of Mexican painters to the time of the Native American founding of this country. We're talking about 1995's Pocahontas. And if you want to hear us talk about a glossy, whitewashed, sanitized movie, strap in.
So can you paint with all the colors of the wind, Kristen?
Yes, and you don't even need to learn my language to know that at all.
All right, well, until next time, we'll see you later.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.